Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here across the Fruited Plain. The phone number, should you wish to be a part of this here program, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. If you're listening in Texas, there's a state action item for my listeners. If you text the word permit to 52886, you'll get back a link. Click it. You can generate an email automatically to your state representative urging passage of the constitutional carry legislation authored by Representative Matt Schaefer out there. Permitless carry. You'd be able to carry your firearm in public without needing a permit. Text the word permit to 52886. Let me just start here. I feel like I need to do this to start here to calm your nerves by saying I don't intend to mean to want to depress you. I don't want to depress you, but I want to read you. So I subscribe to a Substack letter by a guy named John Ellis. He was in the Bush administration. He's a data nerd. He finds a lot of stories other people don't. He puts a lot of stuff in context. This comes as well with, actually, you know what? Maybe I should do it this way. David French at the Dispatch. He's a little bit worried about, are we headed to a World War III? And it's not just him. There's a growing sense that something wicked this way comes. It also comes at a time, for example, that, so Warren Buffett, one of his big indicators for stock market crashes is when the value of the stock market exceeds GDP by so much, and we're at like 200%. It's been a long time sign of a market crash, and you'll have a lot of people now who are into tech stocks who say, well, that's not really the case now. That's an old metric. That metric doesn't hold up now. Things are new. Whenever you hear people start saying rules that have held up forever no longer hold up because we're in new times, you should probably be a little bit cautious because, well, they tend to be the people who embrace the new over the old oftentimes tend to be wrong. A lot of new technologies are just repackaging of old technologies. Like, for example, it's a great example. There's an app out. It's all the rage these days. All the kids have it. It's called Clubhouse. You're either a cool kid who has it or not. If you're on Android, you can't get it, because you're not a cool kid to begin with if you're on Android. You got to have an iPhone. It's got to be iOS. And on Clubhouse, you can get together with people, and on your phone, you can chat. No, not text message chat. No. You can actually have a verbal oral conversation. It's like the phone, except the phone. It's called Clubhouse, and it's a group chat. It's like the old party line. Back before I was born, there were party lines you could call in, and everybody in the neighborhood can call in on a party line and chat to each other. That's what this is, except nationally on your phone. You can sit on your front porch at night when you don't have any friends, and you can chat to strangers on the internet and actually have a phone call in a group chat. And it's like, it's new. It's like an old party line. As an aside, I'm going to tell on myself here for a minute. When I was a kid, my best friend's name was Ryan Ivey. And This was in the 80s in rural Louisiana, and you did not, in your town, if you were calling just in your town, you did not have to have the prefix, you know, like the first three digits. Not the area code, the three digits after the area code, the prefix. You didn't have to have it. So if your number was 1234, you just call 1234. And if you needed to call the next town over, you added that town's prefix. So 331-1234. Well, my friend Ryan Ivey, his phone number was the exact same phone number as the Sears and Roebuck. And This year's store was one town over, and oftentimes the people in town would forget to dial the prefix 683 for that, for Clinton, Louisiana, and they just dial his home phone number. And he and I became masters of sounding like adults to take people's orders until his mother caught us one day and beat the snot out of us. But before that, way before even I was born, that you didn't just have to dial just the four digits, or you pick up the phone and press zero for the operator and tell them to connect you to so-and-so. You had a party line where everybody in the town could listen. Well, that's what Clubhouse is. It's just, it's a new technology, but it's a something old. And a lot of times when people who are into the new and shiny say, oh, well, the old rules don't apply. Well, you better hold up because the old rule's about to come smack them. There's no appreciation for those old rules. Warren Buffett swears by this rule, and the Buffett rule is flagging a stock market crash. Now, I want to read for you, and I realize David French is controversial for people on the right these days. I know and like David and his wife tremendously. We don't always agree, but you know, you can learn from people you disagree with on occasion. And I want to read some of this for you. At the risk of feeling old, earlier today I was on one of those websites that will tell you what percentage of Americans are older and younger than you. I'm 52, and that means more than two-thirds of my fellow citizens are younger than me. Why does that matter? Well, they can't relate to the glories of seeing the original Star Wars trilogy in the theaters. They've only seen documentaries about the Larry Bird, Magic Johnson rivalry. Oh, and they have absolutely no idea what it's like to worry about a world war. I grew up in the Cold War, when bookstores stocked their shelves with books analyzing the balance of military power between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. Debates about ICBMs and strategic bombers could monopolize public attention, and there were multiple war scares that kept Americans up at night with real fears about catastrophic conflict. Then three things happened in rapid succession that changed the world. In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell and the Warsaw Pact unraveled. In February of 1991, the U.S. and its allies decisively defeated Iraq in the first Gulf War, and that December, the Soviet Union fell. Taken together, these events not only left the world with one global superpower, a hyperpower according to some, they established the absolute dominance of American arms. Since that time, America has faced economic shocks. It's endured a devastating terror attack that led to two long counterinsurgency conflicts, and it's faced a pandemic. But the world has been mercifully spared even the possibility of the kinds of great power conflicts that could spiral into world war. After all, who would be foolish enough to challenge the United States? It's against this backdrop that we can see the triviality of many of our current political arguments as a kind of luxury, a byproduct of peace and global stability. Did we really spend entire news cycles on Dr. Seuss? How important really is the location of Major League Baseball's All-Star Game? We certainly do clash over important issues, but the bulk of our energy and anger is consumed in culture war clashes the previous generation would have considered inconsequential. I raise this because I'm increasingly concerned the old world is coming back. I'm increasingly concerned the long peace might come to an end, and we might all be shocked when it does. We shouldn't be. Two things are happening at once that should wake us up to the possibility that the world might change again as dramatically as it did in 1989 and 1991, but with far more catastrophic consequences. First, American military hegemony is in doubt. Yes, we still have the strongest military, but our qualitative advantage is decreasing, and we face the possibility of actually losing a war. Second, our enemies are increasingly aware they're closing the gap and are now today engaged in dangerous and provocative actions. We might find ourselves quickly facing the most serious foreign policy crisis in a generation in Ukraine, Taiwan, or both. Let's first deal with the closing military gap. Here's a graphical representation of the shrinking American advantage over China, taken from the RAND Corporation. The short way of understanding it is dark green is good. It represents American military advantages. Orange and yellow are bad. The picture hasn't improved. War games look increasingly grim. It's actually pretty bad. Pretty bad compared to where we are and China is. In simulated combat, in which China attempts to invade Taiwan, the results are sobering, and the United States often loses. In tabletop exercises, with America as the blue team facing off a red team resembling China, Taiwan's Air Force is wiped out within minutes. U.S. air bases across the Pacific come under attack, and American warships and aircraft are held at bay by the long reach of China's vast missile arsenal. Even when the blue team in our simulations and war games intervened in a determined way, they don't always succeed in defeating the invasion. Why is this relevant? China is engaged in escalating dangerous provocations near Taiwan, dispatching ever larger numbers of fighters and military bombers to Taiwanese airspace. In a smart and ominous editorial, my former colleagues at National Review warned that a Chinese attack on Taiwan is getting closer. They don't argue war is imminent, but as the military gap closes, the determination to take Taiwan persists. But he goes on to point out it's not just them, it's Russia as well. The Russians are increasingly agitating around its borders, building up military to go into Crimea. Europe is nervous. To be clear, unlike an attack on a NATO member state like Estonia, neither an invasion of Ukraine nor an attack on Taiwan requires an American military response. No defense treaty compels an American defense. In fact, I'd be surprised if the U.S. fought for Ukraine, but history teaches us that large-scale combat has unpredictable consequences. It's fair to say that when Austria-Hungary invaded Serbia in 1914, few Americans imagined that less than 3 years away, they'd be mobilizing for trench warfare in France. Taiwan's a different story. While we're not bound to defend Taiwan, we've long planned to come to its aid, and an attack on Taiwan would almost certainly draw American forces into battle. That's why a Taiwan conflict seems less likely in the short run than serious conflict in Ukraine, but less likely is a long, long way away from impossible. French hopes he's being alarmist. I don't know that he is. At the same time, we're moving away from Afghanistan. The Biden administration, I think, is a terrible, terrible, terrible look to say we're going to walk away from Afghanistan on September 11th this year. We certainly, George Packer notes that the purpose of the Afghan war was to prevent terrorists from using Afghanistan to stage attacks on the United States. America could have declared victory and gone home years ago. But if the purpose was to help build a durable state to prevent the Taliban from taking power again, destroying the hard-won progress made by millions of Afghan citizens, and perhaps allowing radical Islamists to regain a base in Afghan soil, then the longest war in U.S. history is ending in defeat. It's a humbling moment. We walk away at the time the Russians also walked away from Afghanistan back in the day, never failing to really impose any semblance of order on it. At the same time, Russia on Tuesday called the United States an adversary and told U.S. warships to stay well away from Crimea for their own good, calling their deployment in the Black Sea a provocation designed to test Russian nerves. Moscow annexed Crimea, and two U.S. warships are due to arrive in the Black Sea this week amid escalating fighting. The U.S. and NATO, anxious about a major troop buildup in Russia towards the Ukraine, signaled strong support for the Kiev government. Additionally, the American military is announcing they're walking back Donald Trump's plans to downsize in Europe and instead are sending more troops to Germany. Chris Dodd, former Democratic senator from Connecticut, and Richard Armitage, a former State Department official, and James Steinberg, another former deputy secretary of state, are moving into Taiwan to have diplomatic meetings as China escalates its combat drills there. The U.S. is urging Japan to issue a statement in defense of Taiwan. Iran announced that it's going to enrich uranium at a level of 60% purity, three times the current level and closer to needed to make a bomb. I don't pay attention now, but Germany is having geopolitical problems. The German government looks on the verge of collapsing as Angela Merkel retires and the Christian Democrats can't decide on a new leader. They're battling it out. Chaos appears on the horizon. Events change things. I always say this, events change things. Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, was asked one time, coming in a wave of government support, how things could disrupt his mandate. And he said, events, dear boy, events. Events change things. Hopefully, events change things and things de-escalate. But at this point, China wants to stretch its leg, not being a regional power, but a global superpower. Russia looks like it wants to stretch its legs into being a more regional power. The United States, we're squabbling over whether boys can become girls. This isn't a healthy global situation. The world actually needs American leadership for stability, and we've given it up and turned inward. And every time we turn inward like this, we get a global war. I don't want to panic anybody, but we need to start thinking and planning and preparing for a future that is less certain than the future we think we're headed into. planning actually helps, preparing actually helps. And I don't know that this government in the United States is capable of doing that when they seem more likely to want to rally corporations to bully conservatives around the country than rally nations to stand up to bullies on the world stage. Hello there. It is Eric Erickson here. I am delighted to have you with me. The phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. If it's allergy season where you are, or it's fish fry season and you got to do it in the house, you need the Eden Pure Thunderstorm. It's an air purifier. It's great against odors. It's also good for pollen. It's good for mold. It's good for bacteria. And it fits in the palm of your hand. You can take the sucker with you. You're traveling. Like, for example, I have got to go to Louisiana in a week to get my dad, take him down to Florida to see his brother who's been in poor health. And I am going to stay in a building that was built before the Civil War. And the last time I stayed there, my allergies went nuts. And it's a great place, don't get me wrong. It's just old. I'm taking my Eden Pure with me. Why? Because it can fit in the palm of my hand. It can use a USB outlet. It can plug into a wall. It is great for room. You need clean air. You need to get rid of the smells. You need to get rid of the mustiness. You need to get rid of the mold, the pollen. Man, is it great. What you need to do if you want one of these, and again, this thing fits in the palm of your hand and it works great. You can take it from room to room. If you're doing a fish fry in the kitchen, put it there, help get rid of the odors. It is the Eden Pure Thunderstorm. That's what you want. You go to EdenPureDeals.com. You'll get $10 off the lowest sale price. You use the code word Eric, my name, Eric, E-R-I-C-K, at checkout. The website is EdenPureDeals.com. Eden, like the Garden of Eden. It will get rid of the odors. It will get rid of the pollen and dust. It's great for mildew and mold. I will be traveling with it. My son uses it in his room. The proof that it works is that without it, he was waking up with a snotty nose every morning from just sleep, and he doesn't anymore because the Eden Pure works as advertised. EdenPureDeals.com is the website. Use my name, Eric, E-R-I-C-K, at checkout to get $10 off their lowest sale price. And thanks to them for sponsoring the program. Let me explain this. I'm getting emails from people asking what the deal is. And as I stretch this show beyond the borders of my home state, let me just talk about political activism. It's one thing for a radio show host to tell you what to think and what their opinion of something is. What I try to do in most cases, some stuff just thoroughly hacks me off and I go straight to tell you what I think about it. But what I try to do is provide you some just analysis of what's going on out there, some actual real-world analysis, not my opinion, but just here are the facts that go for me, the facts that go against me, how I reconcile the facts to arrive at my opinion based on my worldview. I try to do that. I try to occasionally be engaging and make you laugh, sometimes better than others. Sometimes I find the older I get that I have a sense of humor that only I appreciate and the rest of you suck. Like that, for example. But occasionally, I also think it's always infuriated me. And Rush Limbaugh was a dear friend of mine. And Rush actually would sometimes get aggravated with me for the activist component of stuff. I shouldn't be the conservative enforcer. And I always thought if I don't do it, nobody's going to, and somebody needs to just call BS and say this isn't conservative, but also need to be able to rally people to get them involved in politics. And so I've got this action center where if there's a piece of legislation in Congress or in states, I can get listeners around the country to engage with their congressmen or in particular states to engage there. You shouldn't be passive in your listening. You should want to be a participant in American democracy in our republic. And right now in Texas, they're considering concealed carry legislation. So if you're a listener in Texas and you text the word permit to 52886, you'll get a text message back to my action center where you can go engage your members of the Texas legislature and tell them it's time to pass permitless carry so law-abiding citizens don't need government permission to carry their firearms in public. Go do it. Greetings. Hello, it is Eric Erickson here. Welcome back. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. I didn't mean to dwell on this today, but it really does aggravate me a lot, the damage being done by the government to their own cause, a total incompetence. John Avalon on CNN actually did a piece on this, and I agree with him here, and you need to hear some of this.
We're in a race between COVID-19 variants and the vaccines, which is why it was surprising to hear that Johnson & Johnson's would be put on pause while the CDC and FDA look into concerns about blood clots. Must be serious, right? Objectively, no. It turns out that 6 women had blood clots within 2 weeks of taking that vaccine. One has died, and that is a tragedy. But context is key. And this is nearly out of nearly 7 million doses administered at that time. So even if the vaccine is proven to be behind these blood clots, the chances of it happening to you is literally less than 1 in 1 million. In the risk-reward calculus of life, this is not a tough call. By comparison, there's more of a chance that you'll be struck by lightning this year, which is 1 in 700,000. There's also more of a chance of being hit and killed by a satellite falling from space, according to NASA. Or to put it in more terrestrial terms, the chance of dying in a car crash is around 12 in 100,000. This is not to diminish the pain of the people who've suffered side effects, but it is an attempt to put this into perspective. Because your chance of getting COVID if you haven't been vaccinated is far greater. In fact, get this. You're more than over 200 times more likely to get COVID-19 today than to develop one of these rare clotting events. So why did they pause it? An abundance of caution is the most generous explanation. Because this unproven possible side effect is very similar to concerns in Europe about the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is still available there. In some states, people with J&J appointments can show up and get another brand. In other states, appointments are being canceled for the time being. And this is not good. Public health is hard. Don't take it for granted. Perfect is never on the menu.
Perfect is never on the menu. Can we just, let me spend a moment here. Actually, I want to play one more clip for you. Nate Silver, you know, Nate Silver, 538. He's the Democrat who came to fame by calling the Obama race in large part because he had access to their internals. He was a ESPN sports guy, statistician. Now does a lot of politics. Well, he's being blasted by a healthcare expert epidemiologist on CNN.
Legal guru Nate Silver, he tweeted this, 6 cases out of 7 million people. What a disaster, irony. This is going to get people killed, he tweeted. It's going to create more vaccine hesitancy. These people don't understand cost-benefit analysis. They keep making mistakes by orders of magnitude. He does say that, you know, confidence in the AstraZeneca vaccines has plummeted in Europe after its distribution was paused a few weeks ago. So if the risk isn't so great that people can still get the vaccine, I guess the question is it worth potentially undermining the public's faith in the safety of vaccines?
Well, with all due respect to Nate Silver, he is not an expert on the psychology of vaccines and vaccine confidence. And you have two major drivers of lack of confidence in vaccines, one of which is worry about safety and efficacy. The other is a lack of trust in the health system and in government.
Okay, let's just stop there. This is Cecile Gounder, infectious disease expert and CNN medical analyst, taking it to Nate Silver. People distrust government. The government of the United States right now seems to not understand risk analysis. And they can no longer blame Donald Trump here. They're trying to blame Republicans and say, well, it's the Republicans who don't want the vaccine. They're rushing out polling to show it's evangelicals. You know, those evangelicals, they don't want the vaccine. They somehow think it's God's will if they get sick. They're unwilling to accept that the government itself, this government, Joe Biden's government, Democrats, are screwing it up. The contempt for Nate Silver pointing out that they're screwing up the messaging, and this supposed expert on CNN says, well, you know, one reason people are hesitant is they don't trust the government. How much more likely are they to trust the government now when they think the government rushed out a vaccine for the government to say, oh, well, you could die taking it, so we're going to pause it, and a few weeks later say, well, actually, we're going to let you take it. You have a greater risk if you're a woman. And by the way, these blood clots overwhelmingly are affecting women, not men. The vaccine is still perfectly safe for men, but you don't hear that in the messaging, and they want to pause it nonetheless. But if you're a woman, you have a greater risk of getting a blood clot from taking birth control pills than from getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There is already skepticism in America that they rushed the vaccines. Now, part of that is this reason. Normally, it takes years to get a vaccine through development because you have a very small pool of people who are willing to take the vaccine. And you have limited trial runs of a couple hundred people at a time, and you have to build that up. It could take 5 years of testing through pools and pools and pools of random samples of people in order to get it. In the case of the COVID vaccines, more people volunteered to take the COVID vaccine in 1 year than take a standard vaccination, volunteer to take a standard vaccination over a five-year period. Did you know that? You had over 70,000 people willing to take it and gauge the results. And the results are staggering. It is a miracle of modern medicine just how safe these are. Not only just how safe they are, but how effective they are. The COVID vaccine is more effective at preventing COVID, including all the variants out there, than the flu vaccine is at keeping you from getting the flu. You can get the flu vaccine and still get the flu. In fact, you're more likely to get the flu after taking the flu vaccine than you are to get COVID after taking the COVID vaccine. And those who do get COVID have mild cases. There's not a single case globally of someone getting COVID after getting the COVID vaccine and then dying of COVID. But you never know this stuff from the government. The government doesn't tell you this stuff. The government constantly muddies the message. In fact, the government's message right now to incentivize you to go get the vaccine is go get the vaccine and then go lock yourself inside again. Keep your mask on, keep your latex gloves on, and don't touch your family. That's the message the government is selling you on getting the vaccine. It's not a go back to normal, go back to life message. It's a risk-averse message. It is a message of keeping you locked down in perpetuity. As opposed to saying, how much more likely do you think it would have been if this administration and the last had come out and said, go get the vaccine and then live your life. Wait 2 weeks, take both rounds for the Moderna and Pfizer, take the one round Johnson & Johnson, wait 2 weeks from the date of the last round of your vaccine, and then take your mask off and live life. How much more different do you think the messaging would be? How much more different do you think the willingness to get the vaccine would be? Instead, we have government experts come out and say, well, 7 million taking it, six got this clot. We're going to pause for a week. It's Johnson & Johnson. It's Johnson & Johnson. It's Johnson & Johnson. It's Johnson & Johnson. People aren't going to hear it's Johnson & Johnson because when they go get their shot, I had this experience. I went and got my vaccine. I didn't know whether I was getting Pfizer or Moderna until I got there. I had to ask. I got Moderna. The government is risk averse. Bureaucrats aren't willing to take risk. And this, by the way, this isn't a healthy sign for the larger issue. And the larger issue is there is clearly something happening on the planet, globally, internationally, with other countries feeling like the United States has either gone back to sleep or is distracted, is looking inward, we're squabbling with ourselves. And so these other countries are looking lustily at the world, thinking, hey, you know what, I'm going to take a little territory here. I'm going to take a little more here. We used to own this 1,000 years ago. We're going to take it back now. And what can the United States do? The United States is divided. It's near bankruptcy. Its people are sick. And the United States isn't looking at any of this. Our government, and by the way, this is larger. This is not a partisan point. This is not about Joe Biden. This is the entire United States government at this point, Republican and Democrat alike, seems incapable of taking risks. They seem tribal and inward. They're doing what's best for their side, not best for the country. It's a terrible way to go about governance at a time China, Russia, and Iran appear to be a new axis of evil. They may have Turkey on their side, a supposed NATO ally where we have bases working against us. And the American government across the board seems devoid of ideas, incapable of taking risks, incapable of thinking differently, because we're much more concerned at a governmental level about whether boys can have surgery to become girls than whether China might invade Taiwan. The government of the United States is much more comfortable fighting a culture war against conservatives and Christians in this country than going after the Chinese who persecute Christians and put Muslims in concentration camps. And American businesses aligned in the same way. American intergovernmental agencies are aligned the same way. The Hollywood film industry is aligned the same way. Disney is perfectly happy to go use slave labor in China to run their films. And Nike is perfectly happy to virtue signal with Colin Kaepernick here while using Chinese slave labor, essentially, to make their goods in China. The nation seems to turn a blind eye to evil. And when anyone pops up and says, hey, maybe the government should do differently because they're kind of ruining their message on just the vaccine, for example, the government and the talking heads who fluff up the government go out and attack anyone who dares to say, maybe do it differently. Dr. Fauci comes out and muddies the message every day now. He's become the government's worst enemy. I can't tell you the number of people I know who say, you know, at the beginning, I trusted Fauci. And it seemed like when the Trump administration was there, he had a clear message. And now that the Biden administration is there, he has a muddied message and talks out of both sides of his mouth. What's going on? No message discipline. And, you know, ultimately that does, to make a partisan point, come back to the head, comes back to where the buck stops, which is the president of the United States, who himself, I think, is in charge, contrary to some people wondering if he is or isn't, but he's 80 years old almost. He's tired mentally. He wears out quickly. It's hard for him to make the decisions. And the media, of course, is in circle the wagons mode. The media is so fearful of another Donald Trump that they will give incompetence a pass as long as incompetence comes with a D next to it. This isn't healthy for us in any aspect of our society right now. It's not healthy. The Russians and the Chinese on the outside are rattling the chains. They're like the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, constantly testing the perimeter to see if the electricity's gone out of it. And in this country, you got a president of the United States, the electricity goes out of him in the afternoons. He's got to go take a nap. He gets worn out. And this isn't to cast aspersions on him at his age, but we do need to acknowledge he's the oldest man to ever be president of the United States. Yes, he makes the decisions, but my goodness, how slow it goes sometimes. And he gets distracted by the infighting in his administration, and his entire party is about to go into a civil war over wokes. For the government of the United States to be as risk-averse as it is right now, they're allowing other countries to take risks and win because we're not even fighting back when they take the risks. And they know there's going to be a lot of reward because we are sitting on the sidelines, and it has everything to do with American leadership. And I don't mean Joe Biden. I mean Washington in general, Republican and Democrat alike. And all of us are so focused on Washington, we've lost focus on our own backyards. And so our backyards are crumbling as well. You know, again, I'm a big proponent of Jeremiah 29. Seek the welfare of the city in which you live and pray for it. There you'll find your welfare. Every one of us has to be fixated on Washington or feel we must. And we've ignored our own backyards. You want to truly make America great again, focus on your backyard. Stop obsessing about Washington. But how can we not when Washington itself seems completely asleep at every single switch that's out there that requires the government? They won't even take a risk of flipping the right switch at this point. How are y'all? I hope you're having a good day. All right. It is Eric Erickson here. If you're just tuning in, I got to play you this clip from Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois.
What we are seeing with Dante Wright and with George Floyd, with Breonna Taylor, with Laquan McDonald is just a repetition, sadly, a repetition on almost a daily basis of gun violence and a repetition of racial incidents that are absolutely unacceptable in this country. And for those, and I join those who've criticized the other side who say we're just cancel culture, we want to cancel racism in America. That is the bottom line.
We want to cancel racism in America. I don't mean to get all theological with y'all, but what is racism at root? It's a sin. Now, if you're not a religious person, just consider it a flaw in humanity. There has always been and will always be racism, and we should work to overcome it. We should denounce it when we see it. But one of the great problems now is that people on the left want to define everything they don't like as racism. And there are a lot of things that aren't racism. Being against a student loan bailout does not make you a racist. Being unwilling to denounce yourself for privilege doesn't make you a racist. Again, on the left, it does. What's happening is it's harder and harder to take people seriously who scream on and on constantly about racism because so much of what they want is actually racial. The whole idea, you know, a growing body of college campuses now keeping people separated and segregated based on race. Have y'all read this thing? It's circulating. Barry Weiss has a, she was at the New York Times. The wokes chased her away. She's now got a Substack. And she's, this is a teacher writing. She's, listen to this. I'm a teacher at Grace Church High School in Manhattan. 10 years ago, I changed careers when I discovered how rewarding it is to help young people explore the truth and beauty of mathematics. I love my work. As a teacher, my first obligation is to my students. But right now, my school is asking me to embrace anti-racism training and pedagogy that I believe is deeply harmful to them and to any person who seeks to nurture the virtues of curiosity, empathy, and understanding. Anti-racist training sounds righteous, but it is the opposite of truth in advertising. It requires teachers like myself to treat students differently on the basis of race. Furthermore, in order to maintain a united front for our students, teachers at Grace are directed to confine our doubts about this pedagogical framework to conversations with an in-house Office of Community Engagement for whom every significant objection leads to a foregone conclusion. Any doubting students are likewise challenged to reframe their views to conform to this orthodoxy. My school, like so many others, induces students via shame and sophistry to identify primarily with their race before their individual identities are fully formed. Students are pressured to conform their opinions to those broadly associated with their race and gender and to minimize or dismiss individual experiences that don't match those assumptions. The morally compromised status of oppressor is assigned to one group of students based on their immutable characteristics. In the meantime, dependency, resentment, and moral superiority are cultivated in students considered oppressed. All of this is done in the name of equity, but it is the opposite of fair. In reality, all this reinforces the worst impulses. Now get this, pay attention to this part here. Recently, I raised questions about this ideology at a mandatory whites-only student and faculty Zoom meeting. Racially segregated sessions are now commonplace at the school. It was a bait-and-switch self-care seminar that labeled objectivity, individualism, fear of open conflict, and even a right to conform as characteristics of white supremacy. Get that? Objectivity, individualism, fear of open conflict, and even a right to conform are characteristics of white supremacy. I doubted that these human attributes, many of them virtues reframed as vices, should be racialized. In the Zoom chat, I questioned whether one must define oneself in terms of a racial identity at all. My goal was to model for students that they should feel safe to ask ideological assertions if they felt moved to do so. It seemed like my questions broke the ice. Students and even a few teachers offered a broad range of questions and observations. Many students said it was a more productive and substantive discussion than they expected. However, when my questions were shared outside this forum, violating the school norm of confidentiality, I was informed by the head of the high school that my philosophical challenges had caused harm to students. Given that these topics were life and death matters about people's flesh and blood and bone, I was reprimanded for acting like an independent agent of a set of principles or ideas or beliefs, and I was told that by doing so, I failed to serve the greater good and the higher truth. He informed me I had created dissonance for vulnerable and unformed thinkers and neurological disturbance in students' beings and systems. The school's director of studies added that the remarks could be harassment. A few days later, the head of school ordered all high school advisors to read a public reprimand of my conduct out loud to every student in the school. It was a surreal experience walking the halls and hearing the words emitted from each classroom. Events from last week compel us to underscore some aspects of our mission and share some thoughts about our community. At independent schools, with their history of predominantly white populations, racism concludes with other forms of bias to undermine our stated ideals, and we must work hard to undo that history. This was a struggle session. This is Maoist. This is happening in elite, white, private schools across the country. New York is one of the worst off places for this to happen. They are indoctrinating students, not teaching students, and they've gone back to racism. The wokes define people by their skin color, which is racism. Bailing out the student loan industry or opposition thereto is not racism. Defining people by their race is racism, and it's the white wokes who are doing it. Pretty soon they'll all be alt-right, I'm sure.